The opinions and views expressed in this program do not reflect those of KUCI, its management, or the UC Board of Regents. To find out more about this talk show or other talk shows broadcasting on KUCI, log on to our website at kuci.org or check out the latest program guide.
Good morning and welcome back to Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. We are broadcasting from the University of California campus in Irvine, streaming on the web at kuci.org, and always available via podcast. We're on iTunes, Stitcher, however you consume your podcasts. We are under Writers on Writing. I'm your host for the hour, Marie Stone, and we're doing what we've done for the past 21 or so years, which is chat with authors about their books, their process, their craft. Before we did it from a studio, now I am doing it from my closet. And what better time to focus on the dystopian novel? I'm here for the full hour with novelist Gish Jen. I'll mention Gish was originally scheduled to come on the show on March 18th. And if we all reflect back to March 18th, the walls were kind of coming down around us. The station was officially shuttered for in-studio broadcast that very day. So we tabled our talk. And Gish Jen was one of the last live author events that I was able to attend at the LA Public Library. So it's even more special for me to welcome her on this morning. She is the author of 5 novels, a short story collection, and 2 works of nonfiction: The Girl at the Baggage Claim, The Love Wife, Mona in the Promised Land, Typical American, Who's Irish, and World in Town are all available in paperback. She is the recipient of a Lannan Literary Award for fiction and the Mildred and Harold Strauss Living Award for the American Arts, American Academy of Arts and Sciences. She lives in Cambridge. She teaches from time to time in China. I think she's joining me this morning from Vermont. The Resistors is, of course, her latest novel. It's published by Knopf. It's going to be mostly what we talk about this morning, though I think we're going to cover a lot of ground. Gish Jen, at long last, welcome, welcome.
Oh, it is such a pleasure.
Thank you.
So happy to be on the air.
I know. You know, we've had to get creative, and in these strange times, I've probably been to more author events virtually than I was able to attend physically, just because, you know, everything's now, we're all on kind of equal playing ground on Zoom. So it's kind of been fun in some ways.
Yeah, it is fun. I mean, I'm a little bit concerned about my writing schedule because, you know, as you know, writers are asked all the time, you know, would we, you know, do this for this one and this one for that one? And it is, you know, we do kind of depend on being out of town, I will say.
Right.
some kind of writing schedule. And now with Zoom, you can never be out of town. So I'm not sure how this is going to work out long term.
But that's a good point. That's a good point. Right.
Now it really is just wonderful to be able to, you know, keep our little writing community going and to feel like we can still have events.
Well, and it is good for novelists, especially debut novelists, who, you know, all their events were canceled. You know, at least they're getting their way to get their word out. So that's the good part. Yeah. So I first became aware of this book last summer, which now seems like a decade ago. But I was interviewing Ann Patchett in like July or something, and she was raving about it. And I was in the process of sending my only daughter off to college that fall. So it always, you know, kind of started to feel really close to home. And then literally the day before we were supposed to talk in March, my daughter moved back home, of course. And I can't think if I worried more when she left or more than, you know, when she returned. But everything about this novel just rang true. And the only reason I bring that up is to say, I think it's really interesting to have a text, whether it's The Resistors or whatever the text, and read it at different inflection points in life and see how, even if the text doesn't change, your understanding of the text changes. And, you know, I imagine that might be true for The Girl at Baggage Claim these days, too. You know, I just would have read this book very differently 10 years ago than I read it today or even last summer. And, you know, maybe at some point we can talk about that today, too. But
yeah, I think it's true with all texts. I mean, certainly my daughter, who's also home, by the way, you know, just said to me yesterday, you know, like, why do they have young people read the great books when they're like 23? You
know? Right.
And I said, that's exactly right. I mean, what do we understand about what was going on in Anna Karenina, really? Right. I mean, yeah. you have to be older to understand, you know, what Anna Karenina's son meant to her, you know, it, what Vronsky's career meant to him. You know, we didn't understand these things. And I do think that, yes, you read them later on in life and much comes clear.
Right, right. Maybe they just lay down the marker so that you remember there's a book that I probably should pick up these days.
Yeah,
sorry
yeah.
to say. So I don't want to get too far over my skis before we, you know, dive into the nitty gritty. So for those who still may have missed the book, I'm going to let you introduce the resistors, the world of Aunt Nettie, and Eleanor and Gwen, and then we can take it from there.
Oh, well, so this is a book, you know, I will say that, you know, I started this book exactly because my daughter had just gone off to college. And so there I was, an empty nester for the first time in, you know, 30 years. And it was funny because, of course, I had, you know, I had given myself really permission to write anything I wanted to, right? And of course, a lot of my concerns at that moment are very much in the book, because as I looked around at the world, you know, climate change, you know, AI, and very importantly, you know, income inequality, you know, racism, all the things that were going on in the world were very much on my mind. But at the same time, when I really start to sort of actually write a story, lo and behold, my story centered on, you know, a couple with a daughter and watching that daughter grow up and go out into the world. And, you know, that was not intentional. But that, of course, is what happened. So people have commented on how this book is, you know, sort of kind of a buoyant dystopia. You know, on one hand, it's very dystopic. And on the other hand, it's very hopeful.
Yeah.
And I think that kind of captures, you know, the way that I felt when I sat down sitting down to this book. You know, so when I looked out at the world, you know, into which my daughter was launching herself, I mean, of course, I was terrified. And there's a lot to be terrified of. But then when I looked at her, and not just her, but, you know, her classmates, this whole cohort, I just see them, you know, brimming with energy and intelligence and fantastically well-educated. And, you know, and I couldn't help but feel this, you know, this bubble of hope. And anyway, all those things kind of come together in The Resistors. And, you know, a lot of people ask me about the baseball, because, as you know, this is a, yeah, it's a, you know, it's a surveillance state, you know, feminist right. baseball dystopia. You know, it's, I think that there were many reasons, you know, why baseball came to me. But one of the reasons I wrote about baseball was exactly because it's something that neither one of my children had anything to do with, you know.
Right.
So if you can put yourself in my shoes, you know, you realize you're starting to write about a family with a daughter, and the one thing that is very clear to you is that should this have any resemblance whatsoever to your own daughter, your head will roll. So
right.
So baseball, to the best of my knowledge, I don't know if my daughter's ever even picked up a baseball bat. You know, she certainly cannot catch or throw. And that made baseball something, you know, something that I could write about safely.
Right, right. And yet you're all baseball fans, I read. Your family is pretty mired in the world of observing baseball.
Well, yes. You know, I myself am not the baseball fan in my family. My parents were immigrants, and as many immigrants are, my parents were baseball fanatics, especially my mother. In fact, my mother did just die recently of COVID. I'm sorry to say.
Sorry. No, I'm so sorry.
Yeah. I know. You know, we buried her with a Yankees cap.
Oh, so great.
She has a Yankees cap in her casket. I mean, you know, so when I mean she was a fan, she was really a fan, you know.
Wow.
Not long, about 2 summers ago, she had a terrible scare where she was in septic shock. And of course, she was already in her 90s then. And we all thought that she was going to die. And, you know, we're all racing down to her bedside. And my brother's already there. And she's non-responsive. And, you know, my brother's just trying to get her to respond. And, you know, he leans over her. And what does he say? He says, "Mom," he says, "the Yankees are in a slump. The Red Sox are eating their lunch." And my mother, sure enough, she blink, blink, blink. She opens her eyes and she says, "Oh, that Aaron Boone should be fired." Aaron Boone is the manager of the Yankees. So when I see my, you know, my family of Yankees fanatics, I mean, they were, you know, especially my mother was a fanatic. And my brother, I will say, also was an ace pitcher. He just kind of happened into a boys club in Yonkers, New York, when he was young, and they just kind of tried out this Chinese kid, as they called him, because they'd never seen anybody who looked like him before, and different sports, and they quickly realized that he had quite an arm. And so he went on to be one of the best pitchers in the city. And this is a city where there were a lot of good baseball players.
Right.
He was introduced to Tom Seaver. Tom Seaver taught him to throw a curveball. So I definitely have a lot of, I definitely grew up with, a pitcher in my life. But I was not that pitcher, and I was not the fan. I was only the person who knew the pitcher and who knew the fan.
Do you feel like that was their entry into American culture? Like that was their, baseball seems to be the quintessential American thing. Was that their way to connect to this culture?
Absolutely. And that's very common, I will say, because many immigrants will come and they're trying to understand America. And the first thing they do is they go to a ball game, and somebody explains to them about, three strikes are out, and they have a hot dog, and that's their first experience of America. And then that first moment when they start to cheer, is the first time they're kind of, enacting Americanness. I have a moment like that, actually, my very first novel, Typical American, where the family goes to a baseball game. And that's absolutely true. And also, of course, for my brother, he is the son of immigrants in many ways. We do everything wrong. We don't understand anything really, from what kind of soap to use to, to when, what age you start kindergarten. My parents didn't understand anything, right? Once it became clear that my brother could play baseball, he was in, I mean, he was a member in good standing of that little town, of that society. And so baseball was very much his passport, passport to assimilation.
It's so funny because I have to admit, I know nothing about baseball beyond having read this book. And, I know it's the game with the little tiny ball instead of the big ball. But I had this philosophy professor in college who gave this impassioned speech about, and now I'm going to say words that I don't even know what they mean, but it's the sixth game of the 1975 World Series, and it was Boston over Cincinnati, and they were tied. It was the perfect game of people showing their best. Everybody brought the best of themselves to that game, and both sides were sort of rooting for the other side in this kind of beautiful, perfect utopia. And she was likening it to Aristotle's happiness theory. But it is one of those games where I feel like, and the book showed this, where when you bring your best self, your humanity, your non-machineness, I guess, the non-AI, really beautiful things can happen. And it's the book showed that too. So
well, thank you. Yeah, I do think, it's funny because my book is a dystopia, but within the dystopia, there is this utopia. And so, everything that is around baseball and this little league, this underground league that the family forms, is very utopian. And I do think, there is a way in which baseball has always represented kind of, this balance between the individual and the group, right? It's always been an arena in which that's ripe with possibility, in which you get to find out what you really have in you. At any moment, even somebody, has been bombing out all season, can suddenly step up the plate and kind of have this moment of grace where all of a sudden there goes that ball right out of the park. So there's the sense of possibility. And I think in that way, it's always been, and it's been synonymous really with the American dream, right? So, here it is, it's the level playing field. Everybody gets a turn at bat. It's up to, it's you and the ball, and it's just a matter of, what you have inside you, and everything is balanced in such a way to bring that out in you. So this is an arena in which, there are rules that everybody agrees upon. And those rules are designed to enable you to realize yourselves. I mean, all of it is extremely, American.
Yes, right. That's beautiful. How much did the finished product of the book change from your original conception of the, you know, your kind of first kernel of the idea?
Well, I didn't really have any, I mean, I didn't really have any idea of what it was going to be. I mean, I was just kind of set out on this road, and I really had no idea where it was going. This is not like any book I've ever written before. Mm-hmm. I mean, really just a huge adventure. So it's not like the book could kind of somehow, you know, fall short of or be different than something I imagined. I didn't have any idea of what it was going to do. I mean, I think that this will sound funny, but I mean, I think I was halfway in before I realized that it was going to have to end in a big game. That's how little I understood of what I was doing. It dawned on me that I was actually writing a baseball book and there should be a big game in it, you know? Which by the way, you know, for a writer, I mean, when I realized that, I realized both kind of like that there was going to have to be a big game. And then, you know, in a funny kind of way, you were going to have to kind of satisfy the requirements of the genre. At the same time, it's tricky because you have to have something happen that nobody will see coming, you know, kind of regardless of how many books like this they've read.
Yes.
You have to have something that no one sees it coming. And yet as soon as it happens, they know that only that could have happened, you know? So it was a kind of funny position to be in, to realize that I mean, this is not a genre book, but it's borrowing enough from a genre that I was going to have to do what all writers of that genre do. And that was a kind of a funny moment for me, because I've never had a book where, you know, you had a kind of requirement that you were going to have to fill.
Yes.
Like, at the very end of the book, you're going to have to take the LSATs, you know what I mean?
right.
I mean, I had no idea that I had signed up for this. And you know, and maybe if someone had told me that in the beginning, you know, kind of like page 10, that, you know, that I was going to have to do this at the end, I don't know that I would have had the nerve.
Interesting.
Because I would have said, you know what, I don't know enough baseball. I don't think I can write this scene, and I don't think I can write this game, and I don't think I can. You know, I don't. This is like a big jumbo jet that you're going to have to land, and you're thinking, you know, I've never even landed even like a small jet. I don't think.
Right.
Landed jumbo jet, and I think it's really, I should find myself another project, you know. But as it was, you know, I was already so far into it before this dawned on me, and then I just kind of said, well, let me just see what happens, right? And I just kept on going, and then lo and behold, I had gotten my jumbo jet, you know, back down onto the runway. I couldn't believe it. So it was a lot of fun, I will say that way.
I can't remember who said it, but somebody talks about writing a novel like jumping out of a building, and then you just learn how to build your wings as you're falling to the ground. And that's what this sounds like. The plane and the something in that imagery made me think of that.
Yeah, absolutely. And you just hope, you know what I mean?
Yeah, right. What else can you do? Yeah, you just hope. So it's a very political novel in a lot of ways. And I don't know if that was your intent, or if that just kind of bleeds out of your brain because you're writing this in 2017 and the world is happening around you. But talk a little bit about whether you kind of set out to, you know, to get your ideas out there, or if that was a byproduct of just what bled out of you.
You know, it just bled out of me. And I think that anybody, you know, so this is a year into the Trump presidency. And I think that, you know, whether you think that novels should be political or not, whether you think real writers should be political or not, you know, whatever you think, it is impossible, I think, at this juncture to write anything and not have the state of the country on your mind, you know? And so, like I say, it's, again, I did not sit down to write a political novel, but it was inescapable, really, right?
Yeah.
I mean, it's you know, people say, oh, it's so prescient. But I mean, I think I honestly, anybody who's paying any attention at all in 2017 could see that, you know, we were on quite a little trip here. And I guess, you know, and with those things really being heightened by the fact that I had this young person going out into this world. And, you know, yeah, I guess at some level, just, you know, really wanting the world to be very different than it was, you know, so, you know, behind every dystopia, of course, is the desire for it totally not to be that way at all. And I think you get that, you know, as a mother, you know, I just didn't want the world to be headed in this direction, and I wanted very much for it to change direction. And I guess that's to sort of say that it is political, but probably the urge to write these things is probably parental more than political.
Mm, interesting. Well, it is. I mean, I do hear everybody, artists and otherwise, around me saying, "What do we do? You know, we've voted and we've called and we've written and we've protested, and what do we do? What do we do?" And George Saunders wrote a piece, I think, for the New Yorker last month that sort of, like this piece, you know, was set in the future and kind of the same thing. What do we do? And I thought, intentional or not, fiction can accomplish things, I think, that nonfiction can't. That if you sat down to write an essay to kind of tell people what to do, you can't touch the people that a novel can touch, because people come to novels and fiction from all across the spectrum. And so you can lead them through sensory, experiential narratives that might be able to change minds, or at least allow them to see something from a different point of view that you can't do in nonfiction. And so I thought, maybe this is what you do. Maybe this is the highest, best thing that we can do right now, is read and write stuff like this.
Well, thank you so much. And, you know, certainly if I, you know, we just write what we, you know, we just kind of do what we're doing, or at least I do. I wish I could say, oh, I'm going to figure out the highest, best thing I could do is and do that. You know?
Right.
Mostly I'm just looking for that next sentence, you know.
Yeah.
And, but I will say that, you know, but finally, I do think that we writers do perform a kind of service if only we can hearten and steady, you know, people who are resisting, in my case, you know, to help them feel like actually there are other people who feel the way that they feel. If you can give them a kind of a model of what that might look like, you know, and, you know, the case, you know, my book, it's very grassroots, right? I mean, it's not, it's simply people acting from their hearts. And, you know, so, you know, we can, you know, you can steady that part of the culture. And so I feel like if my book, you know, helps any five people, you know, if it helps them get up in the morning and say, okay, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Right. I'm here, and you know what I mean? And I'm going to fight. If it helps any five people, I will feel like, you know, I did my part.
Right. Right. I love the point of view choice. The novel is told from the perspective of Gwen. Gwen's the daughter who's going off to college, and she's got this great baseball arm. And the novel is told from the point of view of her dad. And it's largely a feminist novel told from the perspective of one of the only men in the novel, and a man whose primary exposure or entry into the world is mostly all through women, which was a really fun choice. And I always think it's interesting when novels sort of take the outsider perspective as the person to tell the story. But I'd love for you to just talk about your choice of POV.
Yeah, well, a couple things. One thing is that, you know, a lot of people ask me why I didn't tell it from Gwen's point of view. So Gwen, of course, is the girl with the golden arm. And I did, in partly because, you know, if I understood that I had a problem, you know, a sort of a writerly problem from the beginning, you know, like I say, I didn't realize that I was going to have to write this game, but I did realize that I was going to have to make it credible that this girl was a phenom. Right. Mm-hmm. And that's always tricky, you know, and what you realize is the last thing you want to hear is some girl getting up there and sort of say, well, you know, I'm 11 years old, but you know, I really have quite an arm. In fact, I think I'm going to be one of the greatest. Like, people are going to be talking about me as the next female Satchel Paige, you know.
Right.
That is just not going to fly, you know. So I realized that, you know, if I did want to have, you know, this girl and the sense of possibility in her, and, you know, if I wanted the readers to be invested in her getting to do what she was clearly put on earth to do, I was going to have to make it credible that she had this potential. And I realized that, you know, we're not going to get that by listening to her, right? That you need a witness.
Right.
And, you know, you need kind of an ordinary mortal in the picture.
Right.
Then I think when I realized that I not only had this picture on my hands, but also this lawyer, because as you know, Grant is married to quite an extraordinary woman, Eleanor. Mm-hmm. When I realized that I had two kind of phenomenal people, you know, larger than life figures in my book. And then I realized that, if they were all part of a union, you know, just sort of gender-wise, how is this going to work out? I just feel like, as a woman, I could not have a woman telling a story about her, her phenomenal lawyer husband and her phenomenal pitcher son.
right.
I mean, for me, that's like a total no-go.
Right.
And it occurred to me that I could flip it, right? And that I could, the man is the ordinary mortal, and the women, we have these two extraordinary figures around him. And that just seemed so natural to me. I think also, I was interested in a world which is more feminized, and, knitting, as you know, is a big part of this book too. And there's a way in which a lot of this book, grows out of the Women's March, earlier in the year. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, I'm sure that I would not have, I'm sure there would not be knitting in my book if there's not been for all those pink hats.
Right.
And also, and because of the Women's March, I was just very interested in the idea of a new political order, that was not just about women assuming the role, being like the men, but actually changing the culture, so it's actually a feminized culture. And so all those kinds of ideas gave rise to Grant, who is, of course, on one hand, he is a male, but he was brought up only by him. He only has a mother that he knows of, because his mother conceived of him with, who needs them men? One of the many technological advances that I used in my book anyway. And so, he doesn't have a father, and the question is, is this really necessary that we have this whole, male way of looking at things, which is it necessary that dominates everything? And so I'm imagining a world in which there are men, but which that way of thinking that we have associated with power is not necessarily, the most potent force.
Right, right. One lesson that I wanted to point out for writers is that at the center of the book, you need access to a character who is now gone. Gwen is now gone. She's off at college, living away from the narrator. And so I was just going to point out to writers who say, now I'm stuck in this POV and I need access to these other characters. You have some very clever devices, either through letter writing or things that I won't get into now, because it might give a few things away, to accomplish this. And I just wanted to point that out for writers who feel stuck once they've written themselves maybe into a corner with a point of view that doesn't give them access to other characters. There are creative ways to work your way out of those decisions. And I don't know if once you got there, you grappled with how am I going to do this or.
Well, obviously, as you may or may not know, I have a little, it's not an outtake, but it's like a spinoff from this book appeared in the New York Times on the op-ed page. And that actually is told from Gwen's point of view. So obviously, had I wanted to write that middle section from her point of view, obviously, not only could I have, but I actually have written, as you can see, material from
okay.
her. The decision not to use her point of view was very deliberate. It wasn't that I couldn't do it. I decided not to do it, and that's partly because I'm interested in the parents' fear, and which is that I feel like actually we've had many accounts of people, young people in college, and I'm not sure we really needed another one, and I don't think we have as many accounts of the terror that the parents feel, and I will say that I'm not going to give advice to young writers, but in a funny kind of way. The same way that I was using the ordinary mortal to magnify these two extraordinary figures on either side of him, right? So there's a way in which his ordinary makes them more extraordinary. Well, similarly, this is like watching something happening that's just out of your ability. It's like watching it through a keyhole, right?
Yeah.
And you sort of say, well, of course you want to just go past the keyhole, but actually it's more frightening if you're seeing it through a keyhole. So I would actually argue that the keyhole is a great thing, and that you don't immediately dispense of it because you
great,
can.
Yeah.
That you can get effects with the keyhole that you cannot get without the keyhole.
Right.
That makes
right.
sense.
Makes absolute sense.
Same,
yeah.
Same thing. It magnifies what's the same way that I'm using his ordinariness to magnify the extraordinariness of these figures. I'm using his lack of access to what's going on to magnify the enormity of what actually is going on.
Yes. Right. Right. Do you follow mostly your intuition as you're making those choices, or do you kind of interrogate every decision you make along the way of why am I doing this? Who's telling the story? Or do you, you know, like I say, trust your intuition. And then when you get to the other side of it, look back and say, that's what this accomplished.
Yeah. You know, I trust my intuition and, you know, but of course, you know, with younger writers, I mean, I think it's very important to be actually to think through, you know, to understand your tools and to have worked through them kind of systematically. Do you know what I mean? So it should not be that your intuition, lo and behold, was to do something that you've done before.
Right.
You know how to do. You know, you really should have full command so that, you know, I mean, I'll make people, even my students, I'll make them rewrite the same scene, you know, different points of view, omniscient, you know, kind of limited, da 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 da. You should be able to use direct observer. You should be able to rewrite that scene in any of these ways. And so you're not just leaning on something that you've, you know, a kind of shtick that you've developed. So I feel it very strongly that everybody, you know, that they develop their first full technical range. But that said, by the time, you know, I mean, this is my, I don't know how many books I've written anyway, but, you know, it's a book. And by this point, I can make a decision strictly on intuition, you know, and I don't need to analyze because, and I'm certainly not constrained by a feeling like I can't do it this way. I know I can do it a different way. But I'm looking for, I'm looking for the greatest impact, or I'm looking to capture something that I feel like is the thing that I most want to express, you know? So, I mean, this is fun. It's not, in one way, the book is not at all about me. Another way, you know, I was, as I was writing it, another mother with a daughter who had just gone off to college and was mm-hmm. terrified as to what might happen to my daughter while she's there.
Right. So. Right. It's great. My guest this morning is Gish Jen. The book we are talking about is Zisters. You're listening to Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. You have a great discussion. I think I encountered it online maybe once or twice about, essentially it boils down to an Eastern versus Western conception of creativity. And you articulate it through this pit, which is the individualistic Western notion of creativity versus the sort of flexi self conception through the Eastern lens, and how you're able to bridge the gap between those two. And as you're talking about all of these, you know, tools in your toolbox and playing with form, and all of your books being so very different from each other, and your very fluid way of being able to bounce between these different modes of creativity. I was wondering if you could just talk to that for a moment, because I'm sure I'm butchering the whole concept here, but it was really interesting to me about, you know, I just hadn't given a lot of thought to the Western lens through which we view creativity.
Yeah, you're not butchering it at all. And so I've written a couple of books about cultural difference. And the first book was Tiger Writing, Art, Culture, and the Interdependent Self. And the second book was The Girl at the Baggage Claim, Explaining the East-West Culture Gap. And both of those books, you know, came out of the fact that I could feel a tension in myself between a more Western way of looking at creativity and a more Eastern way. That's very, very, very broadly put, obviously. Obviously, in my books, I'm at great pains to give as much nuance as possible. And at the same time, you know, if we look at this very, very broadly, and like I say, it's a huge generalization, You know, there are kind of two different ways of thinking about the self and therefore thinking about what kind of a highest product of the self would be, right? And, you know, in the West, you know, since the Renaissance and, you know, many developments have led to this idea that that we have a unique self and that the uniqueness of the self is the most important thing. We tend to think of ourselves as having some kind of self, yeah, to which we must be true, which is kind of sits in the middle of us. I sort of liken it to like an avocado pit, you know? Mm-hmm. And our job, if, you know, if there's a cultural imperative, is to kind of express our unique avocado pit, which frankly is an introjected divinity. I mean, I think one of the reasons we feel it so sacred is that it used to be God, it used to be external, but now we feel it's internal, and that came with the Protestant Revolution and so on. You know, in other places of the part of the world that, you know, have not been so influenced by Protestantism and so on, they think about the self very differently. And so, you know, the self is just part of a continuum, right? So in places like China, you are your parent's child, and you are the parent of your child, right? So you're part of this ongoing flow. And therefore, you know, as an artist, what is your job? Your job is to give, you know, to give expression to this larger thing that you belong to, right? So if in the West, our greatest figure is the genius, that is this person who has this spark in them, you know, this unique, incredible spark. Well, in the East, the greatest figure is the master. So that is somebody who has absorbed tradition, who has spent many, many years absorbing tradition, often I will say in the East by imitation. So you imitate the great masters until you yourself have become one of those people. And yes, you add something to it, which is your own. But if you sort of ask, well, how much of it is unique to you and how much of it is your mastery of, I will say, often a very great tradition, you know, it's still kind of 90% tradition and 10% you, right? Mm-hmm. And that's very different than our idea in the West, where, you know, the whole idea is to make something that no one has ever seen before. And, you know, I would argue, and I have argued, that actually we have great works, so something which can be defined as greatness, come out of both traditions, you know, so that, you know, there are definitely artists in the East, which are, you know, works which are just indisputably great, just as in the West, we have things which are indisputably great. But you can hear in me, two things. One thing is that, you know, if you are in this more Eastern mode, the emphasis is on flexibility and kind of spontaneity. It's not so much kind of like, you don't ask myself, is this me? You just kind of go, right? Right. It's more spontaneous. And so therefore, you know, you will see a lot of writers who are coming out of that tradition very flexibly moving from genre to genre, you know, and you see that in me, you know, even though I was born in the West, I was born in New York and I only speak English and, you know, I'm fully American. But you will see this kind of, you know, this kind of, and not only in a kind of adventurousness. I mean, I love trying on new things, you know, and so, you know, for me, in one way, it's very strange to have written this baseball dystopia, but another way, not so strange, because I'm very adventurous and flexible that way. Where maybe if I had grown up in a more purely Western household, I might have been more apt to sort of say something like, well, is that me? But that's not what I do. In other words, it's so much more like it's about defining that pit. And so, well, that's just not what I do. And I would not ask myself that. I would just ask myself, well, is it going or is it not going? You know,
right?
Is this book coming or is it not coming? And if it is coming, then it must be me. You know, in other words, I'm not preoccupied with self-definition that way.
Right. And
I think also, you know, just when you heard me say this about the toolkit and, you know, kind of what I make my students do, you know, which is like, yeah, I want them to be able to write not just like, I feel most comfortable in the first person, right? I want you, right. Maybe especially if you feel most comfortable in the first person, I want you to also be able to write direct observer. So I want you essentially to master, that word master, I want you to master all these things, and then you can write whatever you want to write, you know?
Yes.
You shouldn't be writing that because that's really kind of, yeah, like, you know, I think the danger is that you develop kind of a shtick. And that's, even if your shtick is very good, to me, finally, that's limiting, and you're not going to get 10 books out of a shtick. You know what I mean?
Yes. Right, right. As you're talking about this, I mean, not to bring everything back to present day, but even our approaches, our national approach versus other nations' approach to the pandemic, you know, you can see this as you're talking about it, you can see it, the ripple effects of it in, you know, in not just creativity and artistry and writing, but kind of all over the place. And it's something worth dwelling on. Yeah.
Yes.
I was not smart enough to make this observation, but somebody from the New Yorker made it about the parallel in this novel of our society raising AI as though we are raising a child, and you know, the raising of Gwen and releasing her into the world and hoping she makes the right choices, whatever those choices are, our raising of AI and releasing it into the world and kind of, you know, crossing our fingers that all goes well, and maybe it will and maybe it won't. But you know, we haven't shed a lot of light yet on the wonderful dystopian and utopian ways that AI is used in this novel, and kind of what was on your mind as you were extrapolating out, you know, what the next 50 years are going to look like with AI.
Yeah, of course, I'm not really making any predictions. You know, this is a dystopian. Is that this is, you know, if things go wrong.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, you know, I think that if you look at our attitude towards AI, it is very much along this avocado pit model. So that basically, you know, basically we're, if you're wedded to the idea that the avocado pit is the most important thing, you know, this self, and especially everything in it, its self-expression is the most important thing. I mean, much more important than you know, you're getting along with other people or anything, like, you know, it's being socially responsible in some way. The most important thing is that everything in that pit is free to express itself. Well, that attitude applied to AI is that the most important thing is basically all the potential in AI should be released, right?
Yeah.
So it's very heavily weighted toward freedom. And that's, you know, we in the West, we believe that that's kind of, that is the way forward, that, like I say, it has, it's our sacred cow, really. I mean, in other words, it has a religious aspect to it. And I guess, you know, in my book, I am sort of wondering, well, you know, is that really right, you know? And do we not have other concerns, you know, social concerns that really need to be balanced against that? You know, I'm not anti-freedom, of course, but, you know, but is it freedom, you know, is freedom the only good? And, you know, is it does not, it, yeah, like I say, does it not have to be weighed against other things? And I think it's, you know, it is very similar to the way that we feel about children. You know, on the one hand, we want them to have complete freedom. On the other hand, you know, especially as parents, you're aware that, you know, complete freedom is, you know, might not be the best thing necessarily.
Right.
You know, the college campuses struggle with this all the time, you know, and that they want the kids to be able to do whatever they want, but then the kids do whatever they want and they're like, oof, you know,
right. Right.
This is really a problem. And, you know, but, and that, anyway, I think that, you know, there too, you know, we're looking at the balance of the needs of the individual against the needs of society. And here in the West, we are very heavily weighted toward complete freedom of the individual. And I guess, yeah, when if you take those attitudes and you apply them to AI, I think that, you know, we could find ourselves in a situation that we don't really want to be in. And so better to think it out, I guess, in the novel than it is to think it out in real life. Right,
right. Right. Your ability to, and for having not delved into the dystopian realm before this, I thought was remarkable, but to lay sort of the groundwork rules for the reader without feeling didactic or, you know, this is how this works. You had sort of your own vocabulary for how AI works for all of the technology that exists. You know, you were really creative in putting words together to invent, you know, putting nouns together to invent new words, so that the reader could understand without feeling kind of burdened down by the information that we had to have to understand how the world worked. And I don't know if you have any global advice for people, you know, delving into this realm of how to world build without feeling burdened down by it for the reader.
Yeah, I don't have any words of advice. You know, again, I was just, first of all, I had not even heard the term world building until after I finished my book. It just never occurred to me. And, you know, I was mostly just having fun.
Yep.
And, you know, of course, it's not just technological things, but just sort of describing this other world in which, you know, we unfortunately have built quite a wall between us and the East. And I invented a program called Ship 'em Back, right? Post Ship 'em Back. And, you know, you don't need to know what, obviously it's obvious what happened, right? They were all shipped back. And I did coin a lot of these words for this book, like I say, not just for technological things, but also for social programs. And what I wish I could say that I deliberately sat down and did this, but really I was just having fun, or if you want to call it fun, since these things were really quite dark. It was just a way of just, summing up things that I saw was happening.
Yeah.
And thought were happening, and just imagining a place where they had already happened, and just giving them names so that we could just move on and not laboriously talk about, you know, every one of these developments. I think that if I had sat down to kind of to describe every one of these developments, I think you're right, it would have been incredibly ponderous, didactic, way too long.
Yeah, right.
And also, you know, there's just a way in which, you know, there's a way in which I wanted to capture not the feeling of endless horror that you would have as one after these things happened, right? The climate change, you know, but, you know, what it would feel like to have all these things in the past so that they were just normal, you know, so that all these horrific things were just part of your reality.
Yes, right, right.
And in that, I think I was trying to capture something which was I was already feeling about the world, which were the things which were just unimaginable had become normal. And so, you know, see, so I was more interested in capturing that feeling, which was the feeling that I felt, which is just like, whoa, you know, like all these things are normal, but they're not normal, you know, and the experience that my daughter's about to have in college, you know, everything's been normalized, but it's not normal.
Right.
And you need to think, you know, like I say, more than I wanted to feel people to feel like, oh my God, this is horrible and this is horrible, is to realize like, actually, yeah, you can be living in a reality which is just, there's nothing inevitable about that reality. And you need to be able to back up and sort of say, you know what, we've taken this for granted, but this is not normal at all.
Right. And within that, you still have all of the, you know, problems with your best friends and dating and all the stuff that you have in college is still the, you know, the stuff of your life, regardless of what the political and social reality that you're living through is. And, you know, you were so great at balancing the darkness with the light and the humor. And I both read this and I listened to it on audiobook, and I really recommend the audiobook to people as well as reading it. It's a totally different experience, but the narrator, especially when he was talking about the house, you know, when he was playing the role of, you know, the house talking to the people, was hilarious. I mean, there were a lot of points of light and humor, I should say. And I know you're a very funny person, so you couldn't help it, but it wasn't all doom and gloom, you know? So.
Yeah. And well, and that's, you know, that's true too. In other words, I think that, you know, sadly, even if we have, you know, like all of the horrors of climate change have all come to pass. And just as in my book, you know, we only have, you know, a lot of the land is flooded.
Yeah. Yeah.
Ruined places here and there that you can kind of kayak between. You know, even if that all happens, you know, people will still laugh, right?
Yeah.
And you know, we are the laughing animal, and we will continue to laugh, even if things really truly are not very funny.
Yeah, yeah. You had another piece of great advice for writers that I wanted to point out, which is as you're doing research research, and I know you must have done a ton of research for this, especially in the baseball, right, yes. Right, writing that final baseball scene, that you had advised students not to take notes on what they research, and that, you know, the good stuff sort of sticks to you and it will make its way out. But if you're too laborious about taking notes, maybe it does start to feel didactic.
I stick by that advice. I mean, I just feel like, you know, to use your memory to filter through, you know what I mean? It's really true. People do all this research, right? And it's all really cool, but it doesn't all belong in your book, you know? Right. And I do tell students, you know, don't worry. If it's a good detail, you'll remember.
Right.
You don't forget the good details. And if you can't remember the detail, just as soon forget it, you know?
Wasn't a good detail, right.
It wasn't a good detail, get rid of it. You know, that's for somebody writing a book about baseball. Do you know what I mean? I'm not writing a book about baseball, I'm writing a novel, you know? And for somebody, you know, if you're a coach and you're writing a baseball book, you do have to remember every, you know, put all that stuff in, but not, you know, not in your novel.
Right. Well, we should talk about that final baseball scene, because it sounds like that was the trickiest part of the novel, would you say, for you to write?
Yeah. I mean, I think it is the part that I was the most freaked out about, right?
Yeah.
Until I was writing it, I did not know what was going to happen. And, you know that as a writer, of course, you know, at some level, all my books, you know, I don't know how they're going to end. And to me, if I know, you know, how am I going to, if I don't surprise myself, how am I going to surprise the reader? Right.
Yeah.
But at this point, you know, it's, you know, it was a pretty high stakes end. And,
so how did you get through it?
A lot of coffee.
Right. Do you have readers for this sort of thing? Like, do you have your brother who has ends in baseball?
My brother himself is not much of a reader, but, you know, okay. I definitely had a lot of sports oriented people look at my book.
Yeah.
You know, I'm starting with my husband, who's, you know, not that sports oriented, but he's more sports oriented than I am. And then I would kind of move up the ladder.
Yeah.
To a sort of scarier and scarier readers, you know. But I've done that before. I have to say that, you know, because like I wrote about the Cambodians in Walden Town, and, you know, I'm not Cambodian. And so, you know, same thing. I would start with a reader who, you know, I know understands that I'm not Cambodian and is likely to forgive me, you know, making a lot of mistakes. And then if I pass with that reader, I'll kind of move up to the next level, you know.
Right.
But I have to say that, you know, I do try to, you know, I am pretty careful with my homework. For the most part, I pass with my early readers quite easily. And I'm always thrilled when I get to the very last reader. I pass with them too. You know, but it is our job as writers to try to write it so that you're going to pass with that last reader anyway, you know. I still remember, you know, I did this thing, I wrote about the Jews and in Mona in the Promised Land. And that, you know, that can be a very loaded thing. And I think that when I heard that my editor had sent my book to, you know, to Cynthia Ozick, I was one nervous puppy, you know. And when I pass mustered with her, you know, there's also a way in which, you know, when you get that A from somebody like that, then you feel like, okay, it doesn't matter what the reviews say.
Right.
I pass mustered with, you know, with Cynthia Ozick. And, you know, and ditto with this book, you know, when I pass with Bill Nolan, I pass with Jane Levy, you know, these are people who did biographies, you know, of you know, Mickey Mantle and Babe Ruth and so on and so forth, Ted Williams. And, you know, when I pass with them, I felt like, I just felt like, phew, you know?
Done. Yeah, done.
now I can relax. You know, that's, anyway, I don't know if this is answering your question. Anyway,
No, it is.
The answer is, so I don't go at them immediately, but I do write with the goal of being able to pass with them. And so yeah. I dot all my I's and I cross all my T's. And Yeah.
This gets back to something we were talking about at the very beginning about the unstructured days, you know, during the quarantine, and well, especially for writers who are called upon now to do these Zoom calls, you know, at all hours of their day. But I don't know if you have sort of a structure to your days now that you try to adhere to, or if you're like, this is just a weird time that I'm going to absorb what's going on around me and kind of wait to to write until the dust settles, or kind of what's your approach? Because I feel a lot of writers tell me that they're flailing right now. Their attention span is low. Their creativity is, kind of not at its peak level, and kind of how you're dealing with these days.
Well, I don't want to give other people high blood pressure, but I'm actually used to a very low level of structure. And so I find that there are more interruptions because of all the Zoom calls.
Right.
The fact that I have little structure is not new to me. And I'm actually producing quite well. And but I do have, I do have a little, I don't know if these are tricks, but I can share with you what I do. Which is this, that, I take a half piece of paper in the morning and I will set down my goals for the day. My goals for the day include, 20 minutes of yoga 3 times a day. Mm-hmm. I'm allowed to substitute a bike ride for 2 of those. I have like little things, So today I am going to finish the scene, or I am going to, I will also put, update my website could be on that too. But, but most importantly is I connect with a friend. That's very important to me. Mm-hmm. So these days I would say very typically I get up, I spend an hour on the phone talking to friends. Then I go, I do some yoga, and then I mostly work until dinner, see my mm-hmm. family. And that I feel very lucky. And I'm lucky that I have stuff to work on. I mean, I have too many projects really. So, but like I said, even as I say this, I'm so afraid that I'm going to make people feel terrible that, but I'm very lucky because I'm at a stage of life. I will say that I think what's really, really hard is if you have young children at home. Yeah. And because I do have my daughter at home, but my daughter is college age and very, very self-sufficient. And a great source of joy, I will say. I'm just not in, I just don't have the kind of, I just haven't had the kind of huge disruption that some people are having.
Right.
So that's one of the reasons that this is actually a relatively, I'm not experiencing this as an extremely disruptive, difficult time. If it has been difficult, it has really been difficult because, my mother did die of COVID and, yeah. And I did have, a number of relatives become sick. So, that part has been very difficult, but it has not been, and everybody, but the younger people are all fine, I'm not going to say. But dealing with my mother's death in the middle of all this is very difficult. And like I say, the other sick people, very difficult. But my schedule has been the least of my problems.
Yeah, right, right.
My
right.
schedule is as always, Like I say, talk to friends, do a little yoga, get some work done.
Right, right. Well, this was such a treat. And I, in the middle of this, I was so, so sorry to hear about your mom. And, it's, you're right. Everybody's kind of fighting different battles through this. And, anyway, I was really sorry to hear that. But thank you.
Well, thank you.
And thank you for taking the time out. This was an enormous treat. And hopefully when all of the dust settles and you're back on tour for the next one, we get a chance to cross paths.
I would love that. Thank you so much. And I'm so happy you're back on the air.
Me too. Thank you so, so much.
My pleasure.